Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of American Criminal. In our latest season, the child of Italian immigrants sets out to achieve the American dream. And if he has to spill some blood along the way, so be it. Listen to American Criminal, Al Capone, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get ad-free access to the entire season first, subscribe at IntoHistory.com.
Welcome to the OC Bitches.
Welcome to the OC Bitches.
Welcome to the OC Bitches. Okay, so I am so excited about this episode. We're actually not doing an episode, guys. There's something that people love just as much, if not more, than the show itself, and that's the music. So there's so much to cover, and I know we will only be scratching the surface of the music in this iconic show, and let's just get right to it then. How's about that? Okay. Our guest today is one of the most prolific music supervisors of television and film today. After founding Chop Shop Music Supervision in 1998, this three-time Grammy nominee went on to help create some of the most iconic soundtracks and music moments in history on shows like The OC, Gossip Girl, Mad Men, Chuck, Rescue Me, Marvel's Runaways, Grey's Anatomy, Supernatural, Riverdale, Dynasty, Bridgerton, for which she was nominated for an Emmy, and films such as The Twilight Saga, The Hunger Games, Catching Fire, Perks of Being a Wallflower, Coda, and more. Whew. She was also the chairperson of Music Cares. Welcome, Alexandra Patsalis.
So happy to be here. It's hard to hear all those titles, actually.
Really?
Well, it's quite the accomplishment. I mean, it's pretty, incredible. We've been so excited to get into the music of the show and to talk to you. We've been waiting a long time, and it's just so incredible everything that you've done. I mean, reading this list, I was even like, oh my God, like, I didn't realize you did Bridgerton, and like, the music in that was phenomenal. I mean, I had the soundtrack because it was just so cool, all those classic spins on those popular songs. And
Thank you. It is always fun to imagine a world. And I think that if we're going to talk about, I know what we're here to talk about, but to talk about the craft of music supervision, it's really, how are we defining that musical world? And every world's different. And the OC certainly was.
But it speaks to the evolution of this job title that you have, that's not just defined by one thing. You don't just pick songs and stick it on a TV show.
My job has evolved over the, you know, I started supervising in 95. So a long, interesting journey, from where I started to all the projects that I've worked on.
Did you study music or as a teen, how did that happen?
Such a good question, because I think the answer is always surprising. I was a musical kid. I sang in my school plays. I played in bands, but I was never going to be a professional. I was an enthusiast. But what I really was a music kid. And I was from Chicago, and was a huge John Hughes fan, which I'm sure I'll bring up later, because I feel like there's some very Hughesian moments in the OC. When I went to college, I started booking bands, landed in Los Angeles in the early 90s, and at first worked at a talent agency, then at BMI, which is a Broadcast Music Inc., where, you know, composers and songwriters are looked after as far as royalties. But finally, I started to work for Roger Corman. And I worked for a really generous music supervisor who really taught me the ropes on what this gig is and how you could do it. And of course, Corman's a legend, all kinds of B movies. And I worked on the reimaginings of those 70s movies in the 90s. And I think probably the sum of the 50 projects I contributed to equaled the music budget of one episode of television. So it really was quite an interesting journey as far as how to, you know, how to do that job and how to not do it with a ton of budget.
Isn't Corman famous for stretching that dollar, stretching that budget as the best way possible, right?
It's, you know, it was Roger Corman School of Film, we used to call it.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so definitely. At some point, I started, after Corman, I started my own company. And I started Chop Shop in 98 out of my Los Feliz apartment. And eventually moved into a building across where Amoeba used to be until about a year ago. But before Amoeba was built there, my first television show was Roswell. They are now remaking Roswell, of course. And soon after, I was lucky enough to work on The Mountain with Stephanie Savage. And I worked on a project called Bookies with Norman Buckley, who I know you, I know you've talked to. And that sort of all eventually led me to the OC.
So cool. I think, you know, maybe for people who are listening and they don't really know what a music supervisor is exactly, I'm sure they have an idea because you're responsible for the music, but maybe if you could talk about that a little bit and what it entails.
It's really about, gosh, it's a
yeah,
big question,
sorry.
Rachel.
it's
a big question, but I'm going to try to answer it. To me, music supervision, as I've already said, is really about defining the sound. More than anything, music supervision is a team sport. You don't do it by yourself. It's really, I always view it as an extension, in this case, of Josh Schwartz and Stephanie, an extension of how they are thinking about the show. And, you know, my counterparts in editorial, the cinematographer, all the creatives, a costumer, we're all sort of make up that cross-functional team that, you know, that team of folks that are trying to carry out the creative aims of the creator. So my job might entail any song that's sung on camera, even if a character hums a song. It might entail the theme song, of course, bands on camera. Not only selecting songs for the show, but understanding how they fit into the budget. And lastly, doing a lot of clearance work, which is the decidedly unsexy part of this job, but essential, making sure that all the creative stuff actually works and we can legally get it. Finally, it might entail doing soundtracks, companion pieces, maybe helping with marketing. So sort of music soup to nuts.
We were talking about how prolific you've become, but at that time, do you feel like what you did, especially with shows like The OC, was that... The music was always a character. It was established that it would be a character. That's not true for every show. Like Law and Order doesn't necessarily have music, right? They might have the bong bong, but they don't necessarily have the teen angst, you know, the certain songs that are specific to Marissa and Ryan and certain songs that are specific to Seth, you know? Do you feel like you had a part in changing this industry? And with your choices and your taste becoming tastemakers, so to speak?
It's a great question. I think television was ready for that change. And I was really lucky that I was there at that time. But more than anything, I think Josh Schwartz wanted, you know, he made music a character. And I was able to very naturally... You know, we'll talk about it, I'm sure. But, he, you know, in the second season, there was a venue on the OC called the Bait Shop. My background had been booking. And so I definitely understood, like, how to book a band. But, of course, the characters in the show, it to me, it was so natural. The poster on the wall, like, it never felt forced to me. It felt very natural that... that the music that we eventually chose, and it became, you know, very identified with indie rock. And it was just natural to the show. It never felt forced to me. I never felt like, gosh, I'm trying to jam in something in a place that there shouldn't be music or the characters would naturally turn it on. And I remember, you know, working on getting posters for the bait shop with the art department. Everything was thought about. Like, we thought about it.
And a lot of the bands, you know, that you brought on to the show or selected the songs for the show, you know, there's a lot of indie bands, lesser known bands. I mean, was that a conscious choice or did you just like love certain music so you used it? You know what I mean?
I think I loved that music. I really loved that music. It's the music that I still listen to when I need some comfort, even though it has been a few moments. I think it's the music that Josh liked, the music that Stephanie liked. I think I often got the question over the years, did you use indie music because it was cheaper? And like, really? And, you know, and it was, you know, we never used those bands because it was less expensive. It was really about what fit. And music was really exciting in those years. And a lot of indie labels up and coming. You know, to think about how labels at the time, a little bit previously, people were replacing their cassettes with CDs. The music business was rife with cash. And, you know, in the late 90s and really right before the OC, it was sometimes difficult to get bands to approve their songs for television. There was a thought that if it wasn't used very artfully, it might be whittling away at their cred. And if there's anything I'm proud of the most, I think it's how we really showed how music could be used so respectfully, and really as fans.
So just to ask that question, if you have a particular scene, and guys, I just want to preface that we will be doing, speaking about different seasons and there will be spoilers and we couldn't do the music justice without doing that. There's your warning. But for instance, like, you know, the scene where Marissa shoots Trey, did you, you know, that's Imogen,
yeah.
Right? Yes. Yeah, Imogen. And so did you have to get her the approval or show the scene? In that respect, do you have to show or present exactly what this music is going to be used for? Did you have bands that didn't like certain things or is...
Such a good question, Melinda. Yes, like when you go out to use a song in any film or TV show or advertisement, the music supervisor is laying out exactly what the use will be. And that includes a scene description, a timing within about 10 seconds. Sometimes the band will request footage. Oftentimes on the OC, we didn't have footage yet. The songs had been decided beforehand. So there was a script page, but no footage. And if, for instance, that song got changed to a different scene or if it got extended 30 seconds, I would go back to re-clear it. So a super specific process, and one that I think is really necessary. If you think about all these musicians are lending sort of their art to our art, and I think it's important that everybody understands how those songs are used.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. It's like you have to keep going and repitching something to a band or an artist just to get their approval. I mean, that makes me so nervous just thinking about it. How you do it?
It usually turns out super well, and especially on the OC, bands were really excited and keen to be a part of it, and I certainly felt that shift.
Yeah, it was really impressive, you know, who you had on the show and the songs and the artists and everything. And I still, to this day, I'm just like, holy crap. Like, I can't believe, you know, we got them and looking at the list of all the bands that played at the bait shop. And it's just such an amazing accomplishment and something so cool, like this time capsule, you know, that you created and had, and we had it on the show. And it's just, I feel like, it hadn't been done, obviously, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't know that it's really been done again in that way with having a venue and having bands come on and stuff. And I just think that's something so unique to the OC that you did and Josh and everyone, that is just really cool.
Ah, thank you. I mean, I think, you know, thinking back on it, knowing I was going to come on to, you know, come and speak with you. Of course, like I started really thinking about the OC and thinking about our super musical picture editors, you know, Matt Ramsey, Norman Buckley, Tim Good, and sort of the my partners in the music business, really, that I relied on, like certain labels and certain people who, you know, I was thinking about Hide and Seek and Imogen, and a huge friend of the show, Marisa Baldy, repped Gem and Imogen, and she was, you know, we sort of had a family of musicians that were excited about the opportunity. And that was some of how those very special things eventually got made. The Not a Surf cover or sort of bands appearing on camera was, you know, so many music business folks were so enthusiastic about getting these opportunities to the finish line.
Well, speaking of covers, so is that a normal practice? You had Gem do, I'm going to forget all the names.
Did she do Maybe
here.
I'm Amazed?
Me too.
Maybe I'm Amazed.
Me too.
Right? Mm-hmm. No, Gem did Maybe I'm Amazed. The first covered song is Not a Surf, right? If You Leave. And yeah, I'm doing my research. But is that, was that something that you were used to, or had you already established that practice in other shows, or were you doing it a lot more with the OC? And my question is, what's interesting is I think what I'm picking up on, because I'm an 80s girl. I was a total new romantic, new wave. If there's any music that I do love, it's that 80s music. And preparing for this, I realized how much 80s music and covers that you did. Well, and I thought that's a lot of Stephanie's taste. And now I'm understanding that's your taste as well. So going back to my question, was that a precedent, asking people to do covers for a modern twist, or was that new?
I mean, I certainly hadn't done it before. I didn't have the opportunity to really do it in this way, to have a project so special that artists were willing to take a gamble and, you know, do a cover. So many of those covers got created with a scene in mind. So almost all those covers were a discussion, you know, a discussion with Josh and Stephanie and I, looking at script pages or even just outlines way ahead of it, because we would often shoot, we'd often shoot to it. If you think about that Not a Surf scene, super Hughesian, right? Like, super John Hughesian, like just the way, mm-hmm. It takes over for dialogue. The Gem song, I remember, the Maybe I'm Amazed, I remember pitching that. Obviously, it was important to not only look back and make it very current, but look back to the 70s in that case, and to think about what might make sense for that wedding and who should cover it to give it a twist. And I remember having to go to Paul McCartney's publisher because we tweaked the lyric, you know, just from she to he to make it make sense for a female to sing it. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, like, how will this go? And we got approval and I remember listening to Gem's cover for the first time and Josh and Stephanie's reaction to it. So it was really fun to do those covers. I really enjoyed it.
I just got the chills.
Do you have any, are there any bands that declined or are getting covers? Is it easy to just cover any song, or is, like you said, there's a process or what bands declined to be on the show?
I mean, I think Josh has brought up.
Of course, Josh, like, would remember who said no, for sure.
I know who it is. I know it's
Arcade Fire. Passed. Politely passed.
Yeah, I think he That's one, but I don't know if there's any bands that just said, no, we don't want to be on the show.
There weren't a lot of bands, honestly. Like we were so lucky. In the cover process though, because in order to do a successful cover, in my opinion, you need to have an iconic song. If you don't already know it, it's tough to make a cover resonate. The Ryan Adams cover, for example, already existed. Mm-hmm. We did not create that cover for the OC. That was just a beautiful cover. But the songwriter, the original songwriters, like in Maybe I'm a Maze case, Paul McCartney, you need to get that approval first. And so I would probably say to the publisher, like, here's a song, here's the scene. We haven't created the cover yet, but here's another song by the same band. So you can sort of understand what we're going for. And that is probably how I would have approached it. Later on in my career, I've definitely done a lot of covers over the years, but that was really the first time it was a thing for me. And they lived in the show and, they lived on the soundtracks. And I'm super proud of them.
One of the songs that I realized that had such an impact on me, it was it's the Placebo version of the Kate Bush song, Running Up That Hill. And I remember watching that episode because we read the scripts as actors. We don't know what music is going to, be there. And it is a very manipulative form. It tells the audience how to feel what's going on. And this aftermath of what's happened to everyone with Marissa. I thought it was such a powerful song. And I was like, and I remember thinking, I know this song. Well, because I'm a teenager from the 80s but the Placebo one was way deeper and grittier and it just
what
fit.
What scene was it too?
And
what, sorry, can you?
It's the opening of season 4 and Ryan is beat up
fighter mode.
He's been cage fighting and you see Julie taking pills and you see Marissa, you see Summer, everyone's just, it's the first image of first time we see everyone after Marissa's passed. And that was one of the most powerful scenes. And I've also noticed this leads to another question that great songs, I think you've repeated in a lot of your other shows in different versions of them. Is that correct?
You mean outside of the OC?
Yeah. Have you used that song or some songs repeatedly? There's certain songs that are just timeless, so you can use them in other shows.
I think there's certain songs that just tell a story, right? Mm-hmm. That just tell a story. But I was thinking about that Placebo use too, because it was really up until that point, a song that dark and a performance that dark was so out of character for the kinds of, we definitely used a lot of dark music, but sort of not exactly in that way. And I felt like it really sort of set up, a new season for a little bit. And it can be so forecasting.
Right. Yeah. I mean, to touch on what Mindy was saying about how music really can hand you a feeling, so to speak. I mean, the way the music was placed throughout the entire series and used really just, in my opinion, music is the biggest star of the show, of the OC. I mean, well, listen. I'm just going to put that out there because that's how I feel. But also, not only that, there were songs that actually premiered on the show, which is another really cool thing. So the first time you're hearing them, they were heard on the OC. Like, I mean, the fact that a Beastie Boys song was premiered on the show and also Coldplay, right? Was Fix You, do I have that right?
You do, you have it right. That was another place I had never driven before, the OC.
How did that happen?
I had never, it was interesting to think back on those years. I'm like a behind the scenes person. I'm a behind the scenes person, and to sort of be in the middle of a lot of marketing calls with people very anxious to get their new tracks onto the OC, to be granting interviews, all of that was not what I anticipated. It was like, it was great fun. But I, you know, specifically the Coldplay reference, I remember Josh and Stephanie and I going to Capitol Records, because we were going to hear the new Coldplay, some new Coldplay songs. And we, walked over to my office is about two blocks away at that point, walking over to the offices and hearing two or three songs. And they actually were hoping, to audition a different one, that we would debut a different one off the album. And Josh just loved Fix You. We all did. And we were able to, you know, to make a deal to have the opportunity to do that. And that was heady stuff. It was, you know, I didn't not appreciate how cool that was while it was happening.
Yeah.
That montage in season 2, episode 23 of Fix You is Summer wins prom queen and Seth jumps on stage, Marissa and Ryan dance, and then Caleb dies. It literally is my favorite moment and montage of the whole series. I remember in the first season that as we were plugging along, and I just remember the momentum of the show and the ratings, and Josh was taking songs from his iPod. And apparently, and I don't know if this is true or urban legend, but when he ran out of things, you came about right about the time where he had nothing left on his iPod and he needed to.
That is the yarn he spins, but I would guess that there are a lot more songs on that iPod.
I just love that it's an iPod.
Right. As we see that this show is becoming so popular and the momentum is just gaining more and more and more. So by season 2, you're having Beastie Boys debut, Check It Out on the Strip, and you're having Coldplay, you know, you actually get what you're just talking about. You get the chance to have bands are seeing that this is an important show, that they can showcase their art and their work. And I'm really interested to know that I feel like this show was just that. That was that show in that moment in time. We burned so brightly, and it was not only a show to, you know, to create pop culture and speak through Seth and all of his coolness, hipster coolness, but the music was speaking to the culture as well. So that's ultimately why we had these very, very successful bands on. Is that a good
assessment? I think that's a great assessment. I think artists were eager to be on the show. They and their managers and labels understood we used it with reverence. And I really believe that was part of, you know, why we got so many amazing artists. And if you think back, like there were so many songs an episode, I mean, sometimes 9 or 10, you know, and I know we're going to get into the bait shop, but you know, we had covers, we had regular source, that was just, you know, songs that existed that we licensed. And we had these on-camera performances, so all three ways. And then, of course, we did 6 soundtracks. And something that I remember the most, and you have to think about the time and place. You know, it was right at the beginning of being able to, you know, search a song and understand what you heard and buy it on iTunes. It was right at the beginning of all that. And I remember working really closely with our partners at Warner Brothers Records to put out all the soundtracks. Lori Feldman, Brian Bumbery, Pat Sabatini, and we would send over a list in my office at Chop Shop, a list that day of the songs that would be in the episode that night, what the scenes were that, you know, they were synced to. And it was revolutionary at that point that a viewer could see in real time what they were hearing. They would be able to see the list and perhaps purchase it. And now that seems like life. Now that seems, it seems really interesting to me that you couldn't do that, but it was like a big part of this job, you know, was making sure that fans had access in real time to what they were hopefully hearing, you know, music they already loved, and a lot of music discovery, music that they would, you know, hopefully grow to love.
Yeah, the soundtracks were such a big thing, you know, with the OC. And you said there were six or seven? There were six.
There were six. Right?
And even a Christmas one, right? Am I right? There was like a holiday one.
Yep.
You have it. Oh my gosh, there it is. And CDs. Oh, I miss that. I really do.
Right? It was the Christmas.
The Christmas, of course.
Can everybody see?
Oh my God, hello. Of course it was.
Was the OC the first soundtracks you did? You've done many since, right? For all of your shows?
I have done some soundtracks since. But it was actually...
On Valentine's Day 1929, a group of gangsters was massacred in a cold Chicago garage. The crime shook the country. And even though investigators had only just started looking for answers, everyone was sure they already knew who was behind the crime. Al Capone. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, a child of Italian immigrants sets out to make good on the promises of that dream. But Al Capone's path to success doesn't take him down the straight and narrow. Instead, he transforms himself from a smarter-than-your-average thug into the most infamous criminal America has ever known. Listen to American Criminal Al Capone wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
My first soundtrack I ever did was for Roswell. So this was my follow-up opportunity. Which
it was your sophomore
times,
album.
which we did six yes. times. And I, you know, we had this amazing team at Warner Records, as I'd mentioned. And to put out six soundtracks over 4 years. And the other thing to think about, of course, is it was, you know, obviously a network show. And so we were, you know, watching week after week, thinking about like the soundtrack, when were the soundtracks come out? When would they be fresh? But, you know, also encompass a season of television, you know, obviously in the new era, so much of series work is, it comes out on day and date. And so a whole season of something will come out, you know, at one time. And so it is a little different, you know, now to think about a soundtrack than it was then, which is really like capturing somebody's, you know, memories of the last season. And I remember, sitting with Josh and Stephanie, sitting virtually in our offices, you know, and sort of going back and forth on song choices, on sequencing, and how that would come together. And so it was really fun to work on those.
I'll tell you, I had dinner with Norman on Monday, and Norman Buckley, and I told him that we were speaking to you, and he, first of all, he loves you, and he told me some things that were interesting that very, very complimentary, obviously, but that how you defined, that you actually created the definition of your job title is you just made it so interesting for them. He said that he and Matt would create a list. And I guess every week you'd give certain songs. Now were those songs already okayed, or were they just songs that you liked?
So it wasn't just me. It was like, I had some great, people at Chop Shop, Andrea Von Forrester, Andy Gowan. We would send a comp back in the days that, you know, that you would send a CD, you wouldn't send a virtual playlist. We'd send a comp once a week to the producers and to editorial of songs that we liked, that were not necessarily pre-cleared, but felt like they would fit into the world of the show. And sometimes we did super focused pitches, like episode 2, scene 14, there's a kiss, there's a death, there's a whatever it is, and really dig into the, you know, obviously dig into matching picture. But to me, in order to set the table, you have to have that musical conversation first. And we could sort of, you know, talk to Norman, like, we need more of that band, more Dandy Warhols or more Spoon or sort of, you know, whatever it was. But it was a constant conversation and really, really a fun one.
He said that he and Matt Ramsey literally would fight over songs. He said, no, we'd actually get into arguments about who gets what song. And sometimes he'd win and sometimes Matt would win. But he just said that you guys... He also said that you were very pivotal in getting not just the songs themselves, but actually getting some instrumental versions of the music to lay between the episodes. I wasn't aware of that. In addition to the score...
First of all, Norman is so musical. Like, I'm sure that came across. He was so pivotal in shaping the sound of the OC, as you know. I think he cuts with music, and he just, you know, made so many beautiful choices over the years. And I think I mentioned before I had worked with him on a movie right before the OC. And he was instrumental in introducing me to Josh, because I had just worked with him, but yes. What he is talking about is actually industry standard now, which is to supply a picture editor, with the instrumental version of a song so that you can cut through dialogue, cut around, you know, so that you can tell the story and not get in the way of the dialogue. And so perhaps like he would pull out a verse and you would just hear the instrumental bed. That is really, really, really common. Now it is almost, you know, music supervisor will almost always ask for the instrumental when they're pitching the original song. In the early 2000s, music wasn't a lot of music was recorded in a room. They weren't thinking about a TV mix, which is what that is, now called the TV mix. They weren't thinking about it. They were thinking about, you know, the entire finished song. So that he employed that a lot.
I've heard so many people say that their version of Maybe I'm Amazed has the dialogue over it. They listen to the Gem version, and then they're just used to hearing the dialogue of Marissa and Ryan dancing. And her saying, I understand why you have to go. I love you. Yeah, didn't think about that one.
Confidence, yep. Cohen.
That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, so, you know, so we have brought up a few songs that were obviously huge and pivotal and amazing that were used on the show. But there are so many of these moments that I thought it would be super fun to talk about today and to kind of talk about your favorites and the bigger moments of the show. And like Mindy said, spoiler alert, if you're just watching along and listening for the first time. But yeah, there's so many to choose from, but I think we all kind of put our heads together and came up with some good ones.
Yes, you were just speaking about Norman, who we had as a guest, and his episode is episode 14, and that end where Ryan is running at midnight, Dice is playing by Finley Quayle and William
Orbit.
That's
the New Year's Eve. Is that the New Year's Eve moment, right?
Yeah,
that's the New Year's Eve. It makes the whole scene, everything. My heart.
That is, so it's Finley Quayle, William Orbit, and Beth Orton is the beautiful vocal that you hear. I think that went down on my very first OC comp, actually. Like, I think that was one of the very first songs that made it to editorial. That's actually one of my favorite songs in the series. If I were to look back, and I just think it is beautiful. It was actually a difficult clear. And I remember sweating bullets. And I can't remember if we couldn't find a publisher. It was like the story isn't as exciting as my fear of not being able to clear that song, because once I saw it in the scene, I was quite sure we weren't going to beat it. And so I definitely put in some elbow grease on that one.
Well, it worked out. I know it made me cry rewatching it, just with that song alone. It's so special.
So we had Robert Schwartzman on to talk about being the very first band in, not in the bait shop, but that was a pretty iconic moment. I'm shaken.
Rooney.
Yeah.
Right. And like, I mean, so definitely important for the show. A natural fit for the show, I think. Like, you know, if you Rooney at that, you know, Rooney was so important in LA, so important across the country in the indie rock space. And, you know, they were a little bit of a hometown band, you know, as far mm-hmm. as, you know, as far as the OC. That was the first band that I think I had to organize. And we certainly learned a lot about, you know, how long a band takes to shoot, you know, they're, you know, obviously it's not live. It's not a live performance. When a band comes on camera, they're lip syncing to track. And you know, it's complicated to shoot that to make it feel real. And I felt like we did such a good job on it, on doing that on the OC.
And is that what led to the bait shop, or was the bait shop already planned?
The bait shop sprung fully formed from Josh's brain, I think. I wish I could remember every single thing, but I think he called to talk about it, that this was going to be something that was in season two. And I remember like going to Coachella one year and listening to the Killers demo, which must have been that Coachella summer right before, you know, right before the Killers were at the bait shop, which would have been probably October, maybe November of that year was when it was shot. And how interesting it was for me to, because as a supervisor, you don't think about music as far as how it impacts a person live. Like, we're not thinking about that. We are thinking about like, how does it sound? Is it enhancing story? Is it, you know, supporting characters? Is it, you know, it is part of the fabric of the score, but it is not often a visual part of the story. You know, for in TV and film, unless we have these special on camera band occasions. So it was really fun to stretch, to think about, this is going to be on camera moments. How are these bands going to fit into the story?
You're probably one of the most iconic. How about your Upside Down?
Oh yeah.
Kiss?
What's playing? That's Champagne Supernova, right? Yes. Yeah.
Yes,
that's a good one. Thank you, Mindy. I know. I was going to go for the, you know what I was going to go for, but, yes, let's talk about that. How did that come about?
Matt Pond, PA. One of the most awesome performers ever. Like these covers, we came up with the song first. I can't remember in this case if we were able to talk about script pages. I have a feeling probably Josh told me about the moment. I'm sure that he came up with that song. I think that was a song that he thought would be great for that moment. And I probably felt like Matt Pond was the right person to do it. And he turned in a beautiful cover, like a really beautiful cover. And it was exciting, you know, to call the artists. We'd often get on like a tone call with the bands and say like, this is what's happening in the scene. It should be sad. It should be bright. It should be iconic. It should be emotional. Whatever. Iconic's not a directive. Never mind. It should be. Hopefully, it becomes iconic. But to sort of talk that through with the artists and then get the song back.
Okay, so you have the idea of the song. Is there a short list of bands, or do you have just the one who you want to cover that song?
I think I probably always had a short list in my head, you know, knowing that we had this cover thing we were doing. But I think that in this case, we knew it was Matt, and I probably just had the conversation with Josh, with Stephanie, and then went back to Matt's reps and pitched the opportunity. and then off we go.
And most bands were open to that when you approach them and say, we would like you to do a cover of this song. They're usually just open to that idea because it's an original take and they understand why that song is needed in that particular scene and the modernity. Can you say that quickly? Modernity. Sorry. Of that moment or that opportunity to do something new.
I mean, it's a really good question because, of course, like amazing artists are very sure of their sound and what they would feel good doing, what would make sense. And I think we thought about that too, just vocal ranges and sort of, you know, Matt Pond's music is so beautifully melodic, like, cause mm-hmm. it was, sometimes it's thinking about what they're doing, what kind of music Matt was putting out at the time. And knowing that he could just sing the shit out of it.
And you brought up the Killers, you know, before like going to see them, listening to their demo, obviously Mr. Brightside, another awesome song that was featured on the show. Maybe do you remember anything about that? Like why you picked that one? Was it when you were listening to the demo?
I mean, I think like and it might not have, like it was probably a demo or maybe it was a pre-release. It was before the album was out. I felt so sure that band was just going to connect. I mean, it was just so good. It was all so good. I mean, I'm not sure if we had five songs, we had at least a handful of songs, and sort of thinking about what song it should be, and reaching out to the reps and organizing that show. But, that band made a big impact on me. And you know, although I wished I was, you know, the age although I wish I was, you know, a high school kid when I was picking out, you know, songs for the OC, I was in my mid 30s. And I think especially the Killers, reminded me of some of the best music, that I grew up with. So I sort of was doubly connected to it.
I totally agree. In fact, first of all, I think it was such a great, great thing that we got the Killers. And we started with the Walkmen and then the Killers were number two in the Bait Shop. But that song to me is just, it encapsulates, first of all, the show itself, but also what's going on in the show. It's that super awkward date that Seth and Lindsay are on a date and Alex and Ryan are on a date and they're at the concert and it's just the most awkward date and the song is going and it just has the right, it fits. In that respect, I thought that was such a great, and I just love the sound. And yeah. The weirdest thing is the lead singer. Well, I actually read that they'd written that song in 2001, I believe. And it did, but you're saying it didn't, wasn't produced or it wasn't released until 2004 or five.
I mean, I think the song had not been released. I'm not sure I'm not sure if I was listening to mm-hmm. a pre-release, like a finished pre-release, but it was not, it was still secret. It was still, you know, sort of industry. I had access to it because mm-hmm. I was supervising.
I remember any time we had a song performed on the show, like Mr. Brightside or Shaken, I'm Shaken by Rooney. Like, I can remember the lyrics and the song. So obviously you hear it about 100 times because they start the scene and the song starts over. And I can just hear the Killers now in my head, the Mr. Brightside, so clearly. And I don't even, am I in that scene? I had to have been if it's that, I don't know. I am?
Yes.
Thank you. I knew I was there. I'm like, why is it?
With Marissa. And it becomes more awkward because the ex-girlfriends show up.
Of course. And yes, I can picture us. Patty and like that. Okay. But, and yeah, how the song starts, it's so ingrained in my brain, just like I'm shaking them. By Rooney. It's interesting how that lives with you for the rest of your life. And you know what? Lucky for us that they were those amazing songs and bands because it could have gone the other way, I'm sure.
I have to say that I remember being on set because, like I said, I'm an 80s nerd. That's the music I know. But I remember, you know, Misha and Adam, and people would be excited when the bands were on set. And I was like, who is it? Who's somebody called Modest Mouse? Somebody called The Killers, The Thrills. And I was like, I better check these. I had no idea, but I do remember The Killers very, very distinctly. And I was looking towards, you know, Misha had wonderful taste in music and loved, like, she and Adam had like very similar taste. So if I wanted new music, I would listen to what.
Yeah. I mean, Adam, obviously he introduced me to Death Cab. Clearly, and Bright Eyes was also Brody. Did we have, yeah, right. Like that whole thing. I mean, Death Cab was a huge part of the OC. It was another character, basically, because he loved Death Cab so much and so many scenes with that and stuff. Did Brody actually bring Death Cab to you guys in the show, or was it like a mutual thing? Or
I think he must have, like, because, but, you know, I started on the 7th episode or the 8th episode of the first season, and Death Cab was already, you know, firmly beloved. Like,
I think Josh overheard Adam talking about Death Cab to Misha. That's how he overheard the conversation, and it became that conversation in the car on the way to LA or something, where he says, don't make fun of talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't make fun of Death Cab. But there's a couple more moments, because we do have another guest that's coming on soon, but there's a couple more moments that we do need to talk about that were just so iconic and so important. And we do talk about the hide and seek. We did talk about that, the what you say, and how important that was. So I heard or I read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that you'd have this song, but you didn't quite know where it was going to go. Is that true?
That is true. We were given the entire album early. So we had Imogen's album. I think we had used a song from her former band, mm-hmm. Frou Frou, actually on the OC. And, you know, it was so, that album was just, you know, it's just gorgeous. And in retrospect, we all know it, but like, it was just beautiful and interesting. And Josh wanted to hold on to Hide and Seek because he knew that there was going to be a place for it that was impactful.
I mean, yeah. Talk about iconic, that song.
And then to have it be like parodied on Saturday, you know, that was right.
On SNL,
like,
Dear Sister, I think is the skit. Yeah, it was. It just took off. Yeah. And that song is, when I first heard it, I mean, it was just that impactful. You know, the first time you hear that song, you're like, holy shit, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. I mean, I recently supervised a movie for Amy Poehler called Moxie, and we had a nice laugh over.
Over Dear Sister?
About the skit. Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, obviously an Imogen was so important to the show and, you know, covered Hallelujah for us. And, you know, her voice singing that song. And obviously we had used it mm-hmm. once before in the show, but just a beautiful, haunting version.
Yeah, that's the other moment that we were going to bring up, obviously, with Hallelujah.
Yes. You spoke about silence, which I find very powerful. And because I went back and looked at this scene, which, by the way, Rachel, crocodile tears. It was just insane. Like, I don't even know how we're going to get through that, but that's okay. This is real. So, but it opens on just complete silence after the van. This is another spoiler, guys, you know, but the van and Marissa and Ryan have been in this car accident, and it's just pure silence. And he's trying to check on Marissa. And the way it was edited musically and hauntingly, with the flashback of him carrying her before and now carrying her, it was, the song didn't take over the scene. It was absolutely supportive. And this is when we talk about such a collaborative effort between our director of photography and the actors and the special effects. It's amazing how many people contribute to a moment that is so embedded in our minds. And the song was just the most beautiful choice, it wasn't that many bars of the song.
No, right? it's a short use, as we call it in music supervision land. It was a short use, but it was a beautifully impactful one. And that version didn't exist. We went to Imogen and asked her to do that cover. And, you know, of course it was perfect, you know, when she delivered it, and it was perfect on what everybody had in mind. So much like, you know, gosh, I was lucky, right? Like, these amazing artists and like conversations. One thing we didn't talk about, which like I'm super proud of, was the Beckisode. And we were able to debut 5 songs by one of my favorite artists, Beck, and, you know, sort of make sure they made sense in the episode they were in. It was really fun to do that.
How did that come about?
Actually, Beck is managed by the same manager as Beastie Boys. And we, you know, we developed a shorthand about the show, and we approached Beck about, you know, is this something that would make sense? Not knowing what episode yet. Like, first you just have to be like, does this ever make sense on the planet Earth? And then you narrow it down.
A Beckisode.
You two premiered a song, I feel like, in the finale of the series. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
It is.
Yes, I got that.
Yeah.
I remember it got to the show has such however the schematics or how they figure these things out, that shows that bands that are on the show, their sales increased, the audience increased. I saw that at some point somebody mentioned that it being on the OC, you know, you can compare it to going on the Tonight Show. You're still just presenting your music to an audience of millions of people. And I think that's what the show did.
Yeah. But like, Lordy, it was fun. Like, it was really special. It was really special to be a part of it.
The last band that ever played in the Bait Shop, Cobra Verde, performed as a Foreigner tribute band for Ryan's birthday because Seth didn't like Journey. I totally forgot that one.
I feel like it's because Ben loved Journey in real life. Isn't that true? Is that true? I feel like that's true. Anyway, sorry.
I feel like that's true too. I do.
It's possible. Guys, there are so many moments that we could be talking about, and I know we might not have gotten to your favorite, but I mean, there's over 647 songs.
So
we don't have time for all of that.
We could do a whole other podcast
just
mind,
on that.
we could just go page by page.
Right.
So, you know, we were talking about Death Cab, which was a huge part of our little show. And also Brody just idolized Ben Gibbard, who was obviously the lead singer of Death Cab. We actually have him joining us today on the podcast, which I'm super excited about. I'm a little nervous. I feel like I'm going to be starstruck. But anyway.
I thought about that. I was like, I feel a little nervous today.
I text Brody. I was like, guess who we're talking to? I just wanted to make him a little jealous. But anyway, yeah, he is coming up. We would love to welcome our next guest, Melinda. Will you please do the honors?
Well, everyone, welcome Ben Gibbard, the lead singer, founder of Death Cab for Cutie. Oh my gosh, it's so great to see you. Thank you so much. We are having so much fun dissecting, deep diving this show and understanding the impact of it. And well, my first question for you is that more than any other band, Death Cab, it really defined the OC, and Death Cab Seth and the OC were kind of synonymous with each other. And just, how do you feel about that?
Oh, I feel more than fine about it. I think people have to understand that one day somebody called us up and was like, there's this new show on TV and they're going to use one of your songs in a scene. And we were, at the time, we were not familiar with the show. And we were like, oh, that's great. Because, you know, at, you know, any money from licensing or TV was something that we were, we very much were in need of at the time. So we're like, oh, this is great. And it'll be on a TV show. That's going to be amazing. We'll tune in and watch it. So we tuned in to watch the episode that a movie script ending was going to be used in. And the way these things normally go are the song is playing in the background while things are happening. And the music is not referenced in any way whatsoever. So when all of a sudden the characters start talking about our band, we all just kind of looked at each other like, what? Did they just say, like, don't mess with Death Cab or whatever they said in that particular episode? And I was like, I think they did. And we all just kind of had you know, thought it was a hoot. It was like really kind of funny and like, well, that's like a new thing. This isn't something that happens often. And then as the band was kind of used as almost like a character in the show, it was difficult to process in real time because this wasn't something that I was aware of ever happening before. And it was a really interesting way to use pop culture, be it, you know, the way the show was using music and also film and making references to other things that were not in the show, to kind of flush out the characters was something that I thought was pretty interesting and new in the context of certainly what was on network television at the time.
Right. It was that meta humor that Josh was writing, commenting on what the show was about and using Seth's voice as his own to comment on that pop culture and being that we're in on the joke. We're in on and taking the piss out of ourselves at the same time. And we were just discussing that, how that came about, how your band came to be so popular, was that Josh overheard a conversation between he and Misha Barton, Adam Brody and Misha Barton, and he was talking about Death Cab. And Josh was famous for listening to our conversations. Like he had a cardio bar for me, but he had a Death Cab because obviously being a music lover. And that was how that, and you know a little bit
Brody
more about
was
that,
obsessed
Rachel.
With you and your band, and he made sure everyone knew it. But I was just so happy to be introduced to Death Cab and Follow You Into the Dark. Gosh, if that's not the exact title, it's just like the lyric that always stands out to me. That song is incredible. And he really brought Death Cab to everybody's attention, and it became such a big part of the show and a big part of my life personally too, because he was my boyfriend at the time. And it was just so, so awesome. And it was so cool that you were willing to be a part of it and even came on to perform on the show, which was really cool. And you did the bait shop. And do you remember what that was like or how you felt about it?
It was interesting to me that you didn't play in the bait shop until episode 20 of season 2. And I'm wondering why. Were you asked and did you pause on doing that, or did you do it, or was it something that this, do you know, Alex, too? That might be a question for both of you.
Yeah, I believe we were asked early at some point in season 1, but I think it was a confluence of a couple factors that pushed it in the second season, which were, one, we were touring like crazy and trying to find the time. And we live in Seattle. We don't live in Los Angeles. So, you know, we were touring our asses off. And the little time we had at home, we weren't available to come down and kind of, you know, fall into the rigorous schedule of filming a show like that. And then secondly, you know, I guess we also wanted to see how other bands were presented on the show before we volunteered to do it, to be perfectly honest. You know, you never want to be the first person to do anything, right? You always want somebody else to do it first, and then you see how it goes. And then if when they jump off the cliff into the lake, if they don't break their legs, like, then you'll jump off the cliff after them, right? So you know, I think like Modest Mouse and a couple other bands that we knew had been on the show, and you know, they all had nothing but great things to say. And obviously, you know, at that point we built a relationship with Alex, and we didn't think in any way that we would be, you know, treated poorly or that it wouldn't go well by any stretch of the imagination. But I think just given our schedule and also wanting to kind of see how bands were presented on the show first before we kind of put ourselves in that position were the reasons. But when we were there, everybody on the show was so wonderful and friendly and made us feel really at home. And I mean, obviously I understand, I can only imagine when you're doing a show like that and you're trying to shoot so many episodes and, you know, I know how long the days are and how crazy everything can be. I would imagine in some instances when you have not necessarily day players, but people who are not even experienced actors or used to being on a film set or a TV set in your, up in your grill, that that can be more of an annoyance than a break from the norm, right? But everybody was so friendly and made us really kind of feel really at home, and the cast was great. And one thing that I always remember about being there for that show is, like, randomly Liz Phair was there. And I had grown up like a huge Liz Phair fan. And we've now become at least friendly, but at the time I had met her before. So, and she was there and somebody introduced me to her and she was very friendly and she was like, yeah, I heard you guys are gonna be on the show. So I knew, she knew somebody who was on, who worked on the show or something. So she's like, yeah, I decided to come down and just kind of like see what was going on. And I was like, this is a fucking trip. Cause this is like, this is like this person that I admired for a super long time. So, you know, that was like a cherry on top of the sundae, which was being on the show.
I missed that day. But can I ask you about actually performing? Was that the first time you had, because you, I don't know if our audience knows this, when bands are playing, you're not playing like a regular concert. You've got the music in your ear and it's silent. So the extras, the crowd, they have to pretend like they're listening so that there's, because there's dialogue going on. Did you get to actually play with the sound ever? Or I'm not sure I'm that familiar with the process.
I think you're getting the gist of it. I don't think that we played live at all. Alex is shaking her head no. Yeah, I don't think we did. I think we just kind of lip synced while there were things happening in the crowd. And you know, we'd obviously at that point shot some music videos, but we've never shot anything with a cast audience of extras or whatever. And certainly never done anything like that that involved people just kind of milling about and then pretending like they were into the thing that you were not doing in real time. So it was a pretty surreal experience on that front.
I mean, it's a pretty long, grueling day, right? There was a 5 a.m. pickup and, you know, lugging instruments in a van that you're not going to play. It's a long day. Like, it is, but to try to make it as authentic and real as possible. And the other thing, like, of course, we didn't have a band in every episode, that was specifically scripted. And that might have been part of the reason that you were so far into season two. It was, I'm sure you were touring, you know. When were we having sort of episodes at the bait shop too?
I would imagine that trying to kind of put together a scene like that where you have, as I said, like a band and a huge cast of extras, and then you're also kind of trying to move plot points along, that's got to be like a lot of moving parts that I'm sure most people working on the show were not interested in doing that often. but we had a great time. It was really fun.
I'm so happy to hear that.
Yeah. Once the episode premiered, what was that like? Was there an instant, you know, increase in interest in your band? Like how was the,
it's like absolutely nothing
of being on the OC? It's nothing happened.
Well, it was interesting because now that, you know, the dust has settled from not only that period of our career, but, the show being such a large cultural force at the time, what was interesting from our perspective is when the OC started using our music and referencing our band, we were doing pretty well at that point. We were playing smaller theaters and larger clubs. And, you know, it's like we were just about to release Transatlanticism, if I remember. So this is like fall of 2003. And, you know, so we felt like we were, at that time, we felt we were about as big a band as we were going to be, that there was really not much bigger, you know, before indie rock kind of broke in 2003 and 2004, there was this period where, yeah, you know, if you're selling 40,000, 50,000 records on an indie label, you're basically like the Rolling Stones. you know, in your own mind, and you're like, and that's as big as bands can get that play this type of music. And then there's this massive cultural shift, which of course was spurred on by shows like The OC and also movies like Garden State and other kind of factors. And so we felt that we were already in a pretty good position before the show started kind of, you know, we started working with the show in some capacity. So I have to admit, at the time, I would become a little resentful when people I was talking to would make the assumption that we were now getting popular because of the show, that it was the mm-hmm. show, because our music was on the show and because we had been on the show, that was the reason that more people were coming to see us and there were more people writing about us. And while I certainly would never discount that that is certainly a factor, you know, there was this large cultural swell of indie rock becoming more of a household, you know, indie rock bands were becoming household names in a way that they had never been before. And we were swept up in that large part, as I said, because of the OC. But I think things were also just happening in the culture at that point. But where we really noticed it was when we were in Europe, because at that point, as I said, we were doing pretty well for ourselves in the States, and our records were selling okay. And we were, you know, like I said, playing fairly good sized venues for us at the time. But over in Europe, a lot of our records were not available. They were only available on import. So we didn't have a record label on mainland Europe until Transatlanticism came out in 2003. All the other records were, you know, kind of pre-Spotify, you had to actually physically get them or torrent them. They weren't, they weren't as readily available. So when we started touring in Europe off of Transatlanticism, we got a lot of questions about the OC, and it was really confusing to us at the time. But then we realized, oh, the show beat us over here. It's like people were watching the show in Europe and they were hearing about this band. And the overwhelming majority of people, it felt at that point, were getting to Death Cab via the OC rather than us having had established ourselves over there. And then the show gave us a boost, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And really, Ben, like, there's just the very beginning of your story, right? Like, as far as, you know, your subsequent albums and, you know, sort of reach and fandom.
Well, yeah. And one thing I really appreciated about, you know, Alex, certainly you using our music in the show, and, you know, certainly, you know, how the band was woven into the characters' kind of backstories and everything, was that, you know, at that point, we were not being played on the radio outside of college radio. We weren't on MTV. You know, MTV barely played videos even then, but they weren't playing us. So being on the OC was a way for us to get into the living rooms of people all across the country and in some ways across the world in a way that they would have no other way to access us. Like, you know, people who were into like stuff like, you know, music and shit that we were into probably already knew who we were, but that was a much smaller number of people than were watching this hit show at the time. So, you know, it definitely proved to be a huge boost for us. And, you know, we certainly appreciate it, but there were those moments where we were like, oh, we've been doing this for like 6 years and like everyone wants to talk about the OC, but the show was gigantic at that point. It makes perfect sense.
We interviewed Adam Brody, and I asked him, like, does everyone always ask you about Seth?
So yeah, right. Yeah.
It does kind of follow us, but we were also television and the music industry. It was the era before the internet truly, truly exploded with social media. And I mean, how much do you think that's changed the industry? Like if I know that social media is just, it's changed everything in that we, as artists, we can have control over what we put out mm-hmm. there. How do you guys both reflect on that?
I think we're now of an age, you know, all of us in our mid 40s. So we lived the overwhelming majority of our lives without it. And because our band started in a pre-social media, pre-Spotify, pre-blog era, we had plenty of time to make mistakes and, you know, learn how to be a band, learn how to tour, learn how to talk to the press. We had a much softer landing along the way because we were existing in virtual anonymity until 2003, 2004. And while I'm sure it's nice to go from your practice space to, you know, the main stage of a major festival within 3 months off of a single, you know, certainly if that was offered to me in 1997, I totally would have fucking took it. There's no way that I wouldn't have done that, right? I do think that we're living in such accelerated times. And I think, you know, being an artist involves failing, and it involves learning your craft and learning how to present yourself, how to fail, how to succeed, I think about where I was as a human being when I was 22, 23 years old, when we made our first record. And I guarantee you that I would probably not still be doing this if this band had started in the last 5 years, where, you know, somebody puts out a song that everybody likes and there's just an avalanche of attention thrown onto a person or a band that might not have the wherewithal to be able to really handle it. And so it's a trial by fire in some ways. One can argue that it separates the wheat from the chaff. You know, if a band is, or an artist is truly great right out the box, then they're most likely going to succeed. And other acts that maybe have a hard time getting their shit together or are unable to kind of cope with the stresses of how quickly the entertainment music, how quickly the music, you know, industry moves now, they might not make it. But I'm just glad that we were able to come up in a time where we were able to make some mistakes and learn how to do our craft and not have the world's eyes on us from day one. I think around 2005 or 2006, it was definitely after Plans had come out. We did a New York Times arts and lecture in conversation when we were in New York, and there was a Q&A at the end. And this I'm going to call him a kid. You'll understand why I'm calling him a kid based on what he said. You know, he was a kid, early 20s probably. And he gets up and he says, you know, I'm one of your oldest fans, and I'm curious what you think about all these. And I go to your shows now and I see all these new fans, and it's clear that they only know you guys because of the OC. What do you think about that? And I think the answer he wanted me to give him was, yeah, man, you're one of the real fans. You know, that's what he wanted to hear. And what I said and what I believed then and I believe now is there's no wrong way to discover music. It's not a contest. It's not a race. You don't get a trophy if you're the first person to discover Arcade Fire or whatever. That's not how it works. And there are assuredly a lot of people who heard our music on the OC and were like, "Eh," and didn't care about it, or they heard it and were into it for a brief period of time and then they kind of like got into something else. But there are also assuredly people who heard our music on your show and they became fans for life. And people still come up to me and say like, yeah, I heard you guys on the OC and now it's 10 years later and I'm still coming to the shows and I'm really excited about the new record and blah, 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 blah. So I think that it's there, especially in indie rock circles and like cool kid circles, there's this notion that there's a better way to find out about art or music. There was a more pure way to do it. And I just don't believe that for one second.
Yeah, I love that. You know, just any way to discover something really cool and great, something that you love, doesn't matter where or how, or if it was, you know, all these youngins and watching the OC, as your fan was claiming. It was just super, super special that, I think it was just like a really special time, during the OC and all the music happening, because you were obviously, you know, it's happening anyways with all these indie bands. And it was just really cool that we all kind of came together at that time and it just feels like a really special kind of moment and just super grateful that you were willing to be a part of it with us.
It was my pleasure. My pleasure.
I read an interview with that the Subways had said, it's such a, was a lovely, positive interview. With they said, first of all, it was a spiritual experience, but they said that they could tell when a new generation of people had discovered the OC because they would get a lot of attention. And they just thought it was wonderful that for generations to come, depending on the popularity of the show, that they discover music 18 years later. And they just thought that was such a positive thing. And just to kind of echo what you were saying about it's, you know, it's a wonderful thing to get exposure. However one discovers music is a great thing.
Well, absolutely. And I remember at around that time, I did an interview with Chuck Klosterman, and he brought this point that I thought was really fascinating, which was, you know, years from now, decades from now, this show will be in syndication in some random corner of the world, and there will be a reference to a band that will assuredly be long since broken up, right? And there'll be these characters talking about this band, and there'll be people watching the show that are like, Death Cab for Cutie, what is that? You know? So it'll be interesting to see over the years as, you know, as these things ebb and flow, right? There seems to be kind of a waves of interest in things from the past, right? They kind of come and go. And it'll be interesting to see as, you know, the OC goes through these, you know, waves of like people being nostalgic for it and then kind of tuning back in with it. And maybe it goes away for a while. And then maybe another 10 or 15 years later, it kind of crests another wave, just to see how, I guess at this point, how our streaming numbers will change. Based on that.
But you know, the irony of the episode where Death Cab plays is that Seth misses the concert.
Right.
Josh had to write that one in, and I missed it.
Right.
So.
Which I thought was a really clever way to kind of present our band, to have like the main character of the show miss his favorite band. I thought was really great.
Yes. Right. Well, Ben, we just have to thank you for taking time to come on the podcast and talk to us. And you were willing to be a part of the show, part of the podcast, but just super grateful. And thank you for joining us.
Of course. It's really wonderful to see all your faces again. And it's something that, you know, we will forever be linked in this strange kind of cross-pollination of, you know, pop culture. So I'm thrilled you guys had me on, and it's really
you
nice
too.
To talk to you guys.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben, so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you. We have some voicemails for Alex. People are chomping at the bit to ask her questions all year. Here we go.
Hi, ladies. My questions are actually for Alex today. First, what was your favorite music moment that the OC had? And second question is, what is a song that you would have liked to have been featured in an episode, but never were able to, or maybe couldn't get the rights to, or anything like that? Just was curious. I hope you guys have a wonderful day, and thank you so much for doing this podcast. I look forward to watching it every Tuesday with you guys. Have a great day. Bye.
Am I on? Is that me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I think my favorite, I think we covered my favorite scene, which was the Finley Quay, William Orbit and Beth Orton Dice track, which of course was used in the New Year's episode. I also really love the Death Cab performance and the Modest Mouse performance, the two performances at the bait shop. If I could go back in time and put a song on the OC that we didn't get the opportunity to, I would have pushed to do a cover of Beyond Belief by Elvis Costello. I'm a big fan of Elvis's work. I love that song, and I think it would have been covered beautifully for the show.
Have you since covered it?
I never have.
Heard it here first.
There you go.
Goals.
Goals.
Hi, you guys. This is Juliana from Brazil. I'm a huge fan of the show, big fan of the podcast. And DLC really shaped my musical taste. I was only a child, but it was because of the show that I started to listen to the music I listen now. So I was wondering if there was any resistance from the network to like put more mainstream music in the show. There's just a lot of indie music. So I was wondering if it was an easy decision to put that, or you guys had to fight for that. Thank you.
That is an excellent question.
Great question. Yeah.
We did not have to fight. You know, Josh set the table with the tone of the music. He really leaned into discovery. He leaned into this indie music, and we went for it. And it never occurred to me to think about it. And it also, like, it just felt like we should be focusing on music that worked. We also, as we talked about, used some very prominent artists at the time, Coldplay, U2, the Beastie Boys, and Beck. And that music seemed perfect, as well as, you know, artists that were up and coming. So it was really about how things fit.
Hi, Alex. It goes without saying that you inspired a generation with the music from the OC. But I wondered, do you have any regrets at all? Are there any songs that you wish you hadn't used in the soundtrack, or any that you would now change? Absolutely loving the podcast. My name's Sarah and I'm from England.
What an interesting question. No, I wouldn't change a thing.
Wow. Yeah.
Good answer. I got goosebumps on that, by the way. I hope we just barely scratched the surface, you guys. Just enough to give you a taste. But, you know, obviously, like I said, we could go on and on and on. And when I say I got goosebumps, just hearing those voicemails, the impact that the music had and your contribution and just how important it's been and how it defined so many young people, especially that teen angst as you're in your room listening to those soundtracks or watching the show, is just, this is so much fun.
Oh yeah.
Just so much fun.
The chills.
And so rewarding,
yeah,
to
absolutely
talk to you.
They're just bringing back the memories and chills. The songs we talked about. Literally, I did get like the chills all over my body 5 times at least today, bringing up those moments and those songs. Yeah. And Alex, we so appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. Your busy schedule, and it's just so cool to catch up and to talk about such a fun time and amazing music. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much. You know, I miss this time. I love talking about the OC. I love talking about the music, and it has been, you know, your callers, like, how kind that it had that much impact that they, you know, that they called about the music. So very moving for me, and super fun to be here. So thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. Follow, rate, and review Welcome to the OC Bitches wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you like to watch us, check it out on YouTube or on HBO Max.
Hi, everyone. It's Rabia Chaudhry.
And I'm Ellen Marsh.
And we have a new podcast called Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case. As you know, I am a very smart lawyer.
You are. You're so well-respected in the entire world. You know everything.
Thank you so much.
And as you know, I am a famous Broadway star. Gorgeous. I sing like a nightingale.
Well, yes. At least that's what your mom says. Just kidding. This is Ellen Marsh.
And I'm
Rabia Chaudhry. But we are teaming up to bring you a show like you have never heard before.
True crime meets talk show. Nobody's done it. We're going to do it. We're going to do the impossible. And it's the two things that I love. Ellen, I think you'll like it too.
What? True crime and talking?
Yeah.
I'm there. Every other week, we will have a guest talking about whatever true crime case they are obsessed with. We have a list, everything from the Lacey Peterson murder?
Yeah, some of the most famous cases you've ever heard of, obviously, like JonBenet Ramsey, the West Memphis Three,
Chris Watts, Kalief Browder,
Elisa Lam, Madeleine McCain,
Sandra Bland, the Springfield Three. The list goes on and on. But they are all cases that you know, and we are going to dive in deep with someone else and just talk about them.
No. We're going to solve the case, Ellen.
That's right. We're going to solve the case. So subscribe to Rabia and Ellen Solve the Case wherever you get your podcasts.